Welcome to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Your host, Carl Nordgren, will teach you how to take an expansive view on what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial. Carl is an entrepreneur, novelist, and a lifelong student. For 20 years, he has been learning how to help folks grow their creative capacities. Now, here's Carl.
Hello, and welcome to Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. Folks, I love to talk about how this is the best radio station in the state. And it blows me away to be reminded that it's 5 years in a row it's been the number one radio station in the state. It's such an honor to be here. This is the show that helps you get lots of perspectives, lots of ideas, lots of behaviors about how it is to be creative, how it is to be entrepreneurial, innovative, because I want you to form your own idea. I'm not going to define creativity. I will never define it. But I'll give you lots of expressions so you can create your own understanding. One way is by having guests. And this is a return guest. We were so happy with how the first show went. I've invited back John Swansea. I hope you heard him a few weeks back to remind you who he is. John had a long career, has a long career as an engineer and an industrial designer. He worked both at IBM and Lenovo. John has been granted in this, as somebody, I just can't even imagine that John has been granted 50 patents, dozens of awards for his design and innovation work. He's an entrepreneur. He's an educator. He teaches. He lectures on design and innovation, including a stint a couple of years back at Kenan Flagler's online MBA program. Welcome, John. Thanks so much for being here with us again.
Great to be here.
And, you know, one of the things that I really enjoyed hearing about last time is about your childhood. And I tried to get you to talk about it right away, and you're clearly delighted in it. You had this wonderfully creative childhood. Why don't you remind folks a little bit about that?
Sure. I grew up in a small town in New England, and in my family background, there had been a lot of people kind of making things, inventing things. For example, one grandfather had been a car mechanic and machinist back in like the 1910s and 20s, where they had to make all of their parts. There was no store to buy them in.
Right.
Another grandfather was a jewelry designer. Some other ancestors had been glass blowers and glass workers. And I didn't know any of these people. They all died before I was born. But I heard the stories, and I saw all their tools and parts and half-built machines around our house and basement and shops. And so that was kind of like in the water up there somehow.
And so the glass blowing relations, that would have been, of course, commercial glass blowing, right? That wasn't somebody doing decorative stuff. I'm going to guess anyway that in those days that would have been how glassware was made.
Yeah, it was in the glass factory. And okay. It was called Sandwich Glass. It was a famous glass factory in the 1800s that hired a lot of Irish immigrants. Cool. Who came from someplace in Ireland that was known for glass.
For glass blowing. Glassware. Oh, very cool. Very, very cool.
So with that as the environment, just like a little kid, and this is before the internet and a lot of types of entertainment people have today. And I can remember being a little kid and going up to my dad and saying, I'm bored. And he said, why don't you go down in the cellar and make something? So I thought, okay. And I went down there and there were tools and scraps of wood and metal and pieces of stuff and a workbench. And so I would just make things. I made a lot of boats, model sailboats, model motorboats. And I wouldn't just make them. I would go and then test them. I would sail them around in a big puddle or a swimming pool or something and see which ones worked best, which tipped over, which ones that they were too heavy in the front or the back. And so I was kind of intuitively learning the physics of mm-hmm. what was going on in these different things and kind of developing a feel for materials and all that.
I've got a little phrase I love so much, and you've just made its point, and that is that if you want to understand something new, first get used to it and then study it. Right? First get used to it. Have that experience that you've had with the physical properties of these things that you're making and as they move, but you haven't studied it yet, right? Now that you've got the sense of physics, now that you study it, it's much more likely that your study of it will be more efficient and more effective.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Kind of the punchline of that whole series of things was during my senior year in high school, I built a boat. in the basement, a small speedboat with just pieces of plywood and duct tape and pieces of metal and the handlebars from my old tricycle. I took the outboard motor off my mother's skiff and then drove that thing around and learned how to steer it and figured out what was wrong with it and modified it. And that was a
so you had funny. The you had the pulleys connections from your steering wheel up front back to the motor in the back.
Yeah,
oh,
I had
cool.
some cables running oh, from cables, this, right. literally the handlebars from my tricycle.
That's awesome. And so it makes all the sense in the world that you'd become an engineer, and it also makes all the sense in the world that from that engineering position that you'd find industrial design so very, very attractive. So tell us a little bit about that transition, and then we're going to hear about some of the work that you've done exploring, studying creative companies.
Sure, sure. I knew that, inventing and design was what I was compelled to do. I didn't know what it was called or where to go to study it. I did go to Harvard and study engineering. I thought that I would study engineering and art and kind of mash these two together in my head. I figured out that having an engineering degree would be the best way I could get a job and start paying off my loans. So I went that way on paper, but I really had fulfilled the requirements for both, just because that's what I was compelled to know. And studying engineering, to me, it was like having all the secrets of the universe revealed to me about exactly why everything behaved the way it did that I had initially got this intuitive feel for. Now I could understand the math behind it and really kind of connect the dots
right.
as to the world that I was observing.
Well, another perspective. It's just another perspective, right? Collect as many perspectives as you can.
And so after that, I started working at IBM as an engineer in an R&D role doing kind of studying robotics. And we worked on a little early artificial intelligence and three-dimensional CAD systems, which were new at the time. And that was interesting and fascinating, and I was able to apply my skills to it. But there was something missing. I wasn't producing anything that had an aesthetic component, and it wasn't anything that people were using. I was writing papers and talking at conferences and talking about what might happen 10 years in the future. But I really wanted to make things
right.
that people would use.
Right.
And so that's why I switched and decided to go to school to study industrial design.
And where did you do that?
Yeah, I went to Rhode Island School of Design.
Rhode Island. It's a great school.
I actually had done a summer program at Domus Academy in Milan, Italy.
Okay.
Which was kind of my first immersion to it. Totally different perspective
right.
from engineering. And then Rhode Island School of Design was great, super creative environment as far as you could get from engineering, and really pushed me hard to think in a completely different way
right.
from my engineering discipline.
And we're going to hear some of the application of that. When we come on back from the break, we're going to hear about the companies that John has studied to understand their creative culture. So come on back.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Well, welcome back, folks. This is Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. Thanks for coming back. We've been listening to John Swansea talk about his creative background and some of his education. We're going to revisit his education. Excuse me. We're going to revisit his work at IBM. I guess it was part of your education there, where he had the opportunity to work with an extraordinary man, a man named Richard Sapper. Tell us a little bit about that, John. Tell us who he was and your work with him.
Sure. Richard Sapper is a kind of world-renowned industrial designer, German by birth, worked in Milan for most of his career, and has produced some of the most incredible, beautiful work of anyone ever. He has more products in the Museum of Modern Art than any other designer.
Oh, whoa.
And so he was the corporate consultant for both IBM and Lenovo for a long time while I was there. And for, let's say, 20 years or so, he was kind of a collaborator and mentor. And I've been inspired by a lot of people in my journey, but to work with him was a unique experience, just to see someone of that caliber and be in their studio or see them working on a problem and seeing how they approached it. The speed in which he could generate ideas that were beyond what anyone could conceive was really impressive. And we had a session once where we kind of had an open discussion with him. Maybe he sat down at the front of the table and there were maybe 12 or 15 of us designers. And we just had this kind of open discussion. And I'll never forget this one part where he was talking about his process. And he said, you know, it starts with an idea. And he referred to each new idea as a kiss from Aphrodite.
Oh.
And the idea is you start with that, but you don't know if it's a good idea or a bad idea.
Right.
And you have to exercise it and try it out and explore it and push it until you find out whether it works or whether there's something wrong with it and you can discard it. But I've never heard anyone describe an idea like that, but that's just perfect, isn't it?
That is beautiful. That is beautiful. Certainly speaks to somebody whose mind is making lots of relationships out there in the world, right? A whole lot of relationships. So wonderful. So you work with Richard. Isn't it wonderful when you somebody that you regard so highly and, for instance, in this case, he was a mentor, then also wants to collaborate with you, right? I had a writing professor who wanted to collaborate with me, taking one of my books into a stage play, and I thought, you're going to collaborate with me? I thought that you were way, way, way beyond me. So you had great experience with that collaborative relationship.
Yes. Yeah, that was very successful. And, you know, some of the products that we worked on together are in, you know, museums around the world.
That's so cool.
That's certainly so cool. A high point of my career at that time.
That's so very cool. Well, something happened that you got interested in studying the creative cultures of various companies. And so what led you to that? And can you tell us a little bit about some of your studies?
Sure. I've been teaching technology strategy and innovation at multiple different schools. And I go around and guest lecture on kind of future concepts in voice interaction and products. And so I'm just always on the lookout to understand what makes one company creative and another one not. And there, you know, I teach a lot of examples of like Kodak and Blockbuster and Radio Shack and Sears, where they had all the resources in the world and they just crashed and burned. And I think it was because they just didn't have the mindset to be able to capitalize on what was happening around them and where small startups could come in and just shoot them out of the saddle with starting with nothing.
Right.
So a couple of opportunities I had, and so I teach this in my classes, and I had an opportunity to go to Google's X Lab, which is what they call the Moonshot Factory in Mountain View in California, on a trip out there once. It's this giant building that used to be a shopping mall, and now it's all their super advanced technology and some interesting things about that. First of all, it's all open on the inside.
Okay.
All the walls are glass, which is unlike a lot of research labs where the windows are painted over.
Mm-hmm.
It had this total open culture. They have people going by on, you know, one-wheeled scooters and people with their dogs and rollerblades. And they have this large maker space on the second floor, which has 3D printers and every kind of tool you could imagine. And people can just go in and come out anytime, day or night. And their culture also includes the requirement that each person spend 20% of their time working on something that's not their job. So this is, you know, think of how different that is from the culture of many companies.
3M, right? Didn't 3M do that one in their early growth?
They might have. I know they were very innovative.
They require their engineers to put X amount of time aside to study other stuff, to explore other stuff altogether.
Yeah, and part of the culture there is no matter what you're working on, you can just walk into someone's lab and ask them what they're doing and, you know, maybe you collaborate with them on something. And so that, you know, that incredible facility with this open-mindedness. They also have a culture that's very favorable to failure. So they try to de-risk the concept of failure. And the there's a TED Talk by the guy leading that, Astro Teller, where he talks a lot about how they go after these really big problems and They reward people who find the weakness, who find the obstacle. A lot of development processes, if there's something that's going to make it difficult to succeed, people want to avoid that, right, and they want to work on the easy part and let somebody else worry about that. In this case, they reward the person who finds the critical failure and shoots the project down.
Cool.
That's a part of their culture.
Cool. So you don't keep investing in something that ain't going to happen.
Right. But it also gives people the freedom to start.
Yes.
And to aim at these big ideas.
Yes.
Another one I was able to visit was Amazon.
Okay.
They have their research area and product development, R&D, is in Seattle. And they have this structure called the Spheres. I don't know if you've seen or a picture of that. It's, I don't know, 4 stories high, these giant glass bubbles. Just incredible, like nothing you've ever seen. And inside is the ecosystem of a rainforest. So it's super humid, super hot. They have a whole green wall and exotic plants everywhere. And they have some things in there, like this one structure that's about 3 stories up in the shape of a bird's nest. It's like maybe, I don't know, 12 feet in diameter and can seat maybe 6 or 8 people. And to get to it, you walk across this kind of rickety rope bridge. And it's just like nothing you could ever imagine. And it's that and other places in this space is where people can just meet and talk about stuff and have new ideas. And it's the whole idea of placing you in completely unfamiliar surroundings.
Well, I love the picture of that rickety bridge as being a reminder that you're leaving one place and now you're really intentional entering a whole new place. John's got more to share with us, folks, when we come on back from the break. I'm looking forward to hearing it. Hope you are too.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back, folks. Thanks for coming back. We're listening to John Swansea. I want to remind you that this is his second show. He's had so many wonderful ideas about creative childhood, about engineering, about industrial design, about how to be creative. What we want to hear now, John, is I know you have a lot of experience helping MBA and design students develop their creativity. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure, sure. That's part of trying to convey what I know and form it into some method or exercises so that other people can pick up on this and be able to do it. I'll talk a little bit about teaching design students and who are a completely different breed, almost a different species than MBA students. I could go on and on about that. But it's still part of the idea is this idea like immediately creating something. Make your first prototype first. Make your concept. Try these ideas. Just build something and try it and compare it to the next one. And just completely dive in. Don't wait until you're sure you have the right idea.
Okay.
It's this process of discovery that's both mental and physical. And to just push them to do that. Many may hesitate or they're a little afraid. They're going to wait and see what somebody else does first. Is to just absolutely dive in with both hands and both feet and make the process happen. I was asking one design student once, you know, she was showing me her work and I said, you know, why did you do it this way? And she said, well, I'm using this method because I'm comfortable with that. And I said, wait, stop. You shouldn't, this is a design school. You shouldn't feel the need to do something you're comfortable with. Force yourself to do something you're not comfortable with. And the quote I use for that is, the ship is safe in the harbor, but that's not what ships are for.
Right on. Right on.
And another example from that same course is some students, they'd start drawing some little sketch on a piece of paper, and I would say, you know, do it full size. Do it in 3 dimensions. You know, discover immediately what it is. And one of the things I did for them, some people were designing wearable devices.
Okay.
And they're trying to sketch it on a piece of copy paper. And so I went and bought a full-size mannequin from a used mannequin store. And I bought a, you know, full-sized head mannequin wig stand. And And so if you're designing glasses,
ah,
design it onto this mannequin.
Oh, how cool.
In real full-size three dimensions.
Oh, how cool.
And if you're designing, you know, this electronic device to measure your muscles or something, draw it directly on this full-size mannequin.
Oh, very cool.
And in any sense where you can go full-size or three dimensions as soon as possible.
Yes.
Lets you discover what's right or wrong.
Well, this is not quite what you're talking about, but I would bring – when I taught at Duke, I would bring in a visual arts teacher to just give them a little 15-minute prompt on how to be a visual thinkers because they would have to be visual in their journals. And he would talk about the research that shows that the larger the image – when you give yourself permission to make a large, large image, you're engaging more of your creative mind. The larger the image, the more your full creative mind is engaged. So I would tell the kids, just fill the page, man. Just fill the page with that image. Have it spilling off over the sides of the page.
Yeah. And especially if it's something that a person is going to physically interact with.
Yes.
The scale is important. The balance is important. You know, whether the edges are sharp or smooth is important. And you can't get that by looking at a sketch.
Right.
Or even a computer three-dimensional image, you can't. So in terms of the business school students, what's challenging for them is it's more than just a product. They're thinking about the entire ecosystem of a product, a service, you know, revenue streams, customers, relationships, brands, et cetera. And all of those axes are areas for possible innovation. And if you look at companies that are really innovative, like, I mean, Tesla, for example, is one, kind of controversial right now, but that was a very revolutionary company in terms of how many different elements of their business model were innovative compared to the legacy auto industry.
Okay.
And so there are many examples of like that. And so that's what I'm trying to encourage them to imagine innovating on all of these different axes.
Right, right.
And that can be hard for them to do. So we go through exercises. I show them examples.
Well, I don't have any really good image of where MBA programs are these days. But back in the day when I did, 25, 30 years ago, I was always a little dismayed that they seemed to be much more interested in teaching students how to measure value as opposed to how to create value. Is that less so now?
Well, I'm sure there's still plenty of accounting and finance classes at the MBA programs, which I'd be completely unqualified to teach. But what I try to teach them is that innovation is a process, but unlike a lot of the things that MBAers are focused on, it's not predictable, it's not measurable, it's not repeatable. And so it kind of goes against all of those kind of rigid metrics.
Right.
But still, it's essential and can generate enormous business value.
Right. No, it's messy. True innovation is certainly messy. Well, what's your advice for others? We've got about a minute left here now. John, I'd love to hear some advice that you've got for the folks who are listening.
Well, it's like some of the things we were talking about. Part of it is just kind of the mental limberness of not constraining yourself with anything.
Right.
You know, look at everything from a new angle, from a different light, from a different perspective. You know, assume that you can break any of the rules and just see what happens conceptually. And then things like it says in your book, this idea of ready, fire, aim is just start doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Don't wait until it's fully formed because your first idea is probably not going to be a right one.
Right.
But just start spilling them out there.
Right.
And make it someplace where you can look and see them all at the same time and refer to them. And like, I want the top half of A, the bottom half of B. And I like number C, except turn it upside down.
Right.
And so that you're really able to kind of dance between all of these different concepts simultaneously. And out of that process, iteratively getting feedback from other people will emerge the best possible idea you could have had given the environment.
I love this idea of dancing. We'll frequently talk about this creative concept and this creative concept dancing together, a bias for action and multiple creative perspectives. Those dance together, right? If you got bias for action, you're getting new perspectives. To get new perspectives, you probably have to be in motion. John, thank you so much for being my guest. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of the day. Folks, I hope you enjoyed listening to John share his wisdoms with you. This is Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. Thanks for listening.
This has been Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. You can listen to other episodes on chapelboro.com.